Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. My guest for this morning is Natasha Stoyanov. She is a New York Times best-selling author and journalist who has worked with acclaimed psychic medium John Edwards, as well as others on books about miracles. Natasha and I will be discussing her latest collaboration with Chicken Soup for the Soul on their latest release titled Hope and Miracles, 101 Inspirational Stories of Faith, Answered Prayers, and Divine Intervention. Good morning, Natasha. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning, Johnny. I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing fantastic. It is a pleasure to have you on the air. I have to tell you, Hope and Miracles is a very interesting and moving read. The stories are extraordinary, unexplainable, but most importantly, what I gather from it is that they provide evidence that there are powers beyond our comprehension that everyone can actually experience for their highest good.
I agree. And the amazing thing is that most people do experience these things. It doesn't matter where you live, what your beliefs are, how old you are, these things happen.
Fantastic. By the way, the book release date, I believe, is February the 10th, so congratulations.
Thank you.
Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Okay. I'm Canadian. I was born in Toronto, grew up in Toronto, and I studied journalism there. I got a BA in English there in Toronto and studied journalism and became a news reporter. And crazily enough, my career in journalism and writing began as a 17-year-old paparazzi photographer. I would have a little sure shot. I know, it's crazy. I was just this sort of sweet teenage girl who would have a little sure shot camera. A friend of mine worked at one of the Four Seasons Hotel, and I would take pictures of all these celebrities who came in, and I would run them over to the newspaper, and they would publish them on the front page. And they said, well, you know, you should try to get some interviews from these people while you meet them. So I started doing that, and that's how I became a journalist, really. I started getting interviews with Bruce Springsteen and all these guys at age 17, 18, the newspapers were, I know, people who were not giving interviews. And, you know, when a sweet young girl with a little sure shot politely asks you for an interview, you give it to her. So I ended up going to journalism school. And from there, I decided, and this is actually a little Hope and Miracle story. Mm-hmm. One day in school, I decided I was going to be the Toronto correspondent for People magazine. My teacher had said something about how he had once been a Toronto correspondent, but they haven't had a correspondent in a long time. And I thought, I'm going to be the correspondent. I went to the page with all the editors' names, and I picked a name, and I put all my stories together, and I sent them to People magazine. Lo and behold, a week later, I got a call from one of the top editors saying, you won't believe it, but we had a big meeting this morning with all the editors, and I was told by the managing editor to find a correspondent in Toronto. And I got back to my desk, and there was your package with all your stuff. So I became a Toronto correspondent for People magazine. I know. Eventually moving to New York and becoming a staff on staff there as a writer for film and human interest stories.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, I started writing books because I would meet people who were starting to write books, and we would have a camaraderie, and they would call me up and say, would you be interested? And that's how the books began. And here we are.
You have fascinating stories, and I'm sure the people that you met are so rich in character.
Oh, they are. Well, that's one great thing about being a writer and a journalist. Every day you're meeting somebody different and usually you're meeting people because you're writing about them. You're meeting people who have done amazing things, have an amazing story to tell, and you are sort of the conduit. You're the messenger for them, which is great because you live all these stories with them, and you help express them for other people, which is, I think, a great job to have.
Wonderful. What life's epiphanies led you to a career in writing about hope and miracles?
I think even as a kid, I myself would be so inspired by any stories I read, any biographies, especially if I saw a movie about someone not giving up hope and then something happens that helps them. Even if you look at something like It's a Wonderful Life, that, you know, the Jimmy Stewart film that you watch every year at the holiday season, and you see these miracles happening for his character. Big miracle in the end. I myself love the idea of finishing reading a book or walking out of a movie theater and feeling uplifted and inspired and full of hope. And I think somewhere along the way, as I would be interviewing people, I decided that's what I enjoyed the most writing about as well. And I think that probably when I started, and you know, sometimes you think you can write a story that lifts a person's spirit up and you can save their life. I mean, this is no small thing because I know for me there are times, you know, me and my friends, family, when you're so down and you hear a story of hope, and that's a difference between you, you know, not me personally, but jumping off a bridge or not.
Right.
You know, life is tough, and we want to sort of try and help each other keep going. Mm-hmm. So I think for me, then when I started doing books with John Edward, and I started seeing what I followed him all over the world, and I saw him do hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of readings everywhere, from Australia to, you know, where Canada. And when I would see how uplifted people would be at the feeling of hope that maybe there was an energy out there, maybe we don't die, maybe things happen and energy can swirl about to make a beautiful thing happen in our life, that's probably what got me started on it.
Very interesting. Spending the time with John Edwards, traveling, and him being able to do what he does best, how does that impact you in terms of your idea of hope, love, and perhaps miracles? And I know you have to believe in them, but in the sense that you are an outsider and looking in through this lens of love and hope, what does it feel for you?
Well, the amazing thing is... It's funny. Keeping on the John Edwards theme, when I started writing books with him, I remember thinking, I want something to happen to me.
Yeah.
And yet I was the writer, and I kept writing about other people's little miracles.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole time we were working on our first book together, you know, my mother had passed away. You know, I should have used this story in the book. I totally forgot about this. But my family's all over the book anyway, so my mother had passed away, but I had never told him so. I didn't want to tell him because I wanted something to happen suddenly in a surprise way that she would suddenly hear and he would get a message from her and tell me about it. I didn't want to taint it. I didn't want him to know. But the whole time we were working on the first book, nothing would ever happen. And I would be in a room sometimes with 25 people, and each person in that room would get a reading from him, and I wasn't. Mm-hmm. And I remember once just sobbing, coming home from one of his readings, thinking, why not me? Mm-hmm. And I went to my mother's grave in Toronto, and I said, Mom, okay, I understand that I can't have, you know, this work based on the fact that I want you to show up. But if you decide to show up, you mention the chocolate. When I used to go to her grave, I used to break a piece of chocolate and give it to her, and I would eat half of it. It was a little ritual we did. Well, lo and behold, in the very last interview we did, John, my mother shows up talking about the chocolate. So the point is that I've never been an outsider as I write about these people. Something always happens for me as well. So that keeps my belief going in hope and miracles.
So it's interesting that the time spent was very enriching for you spiritually as well.
Yes, I think so. And the other thing I like about it is that it's a universal kind of a spirituality that I've seen and have embraced and that, I mean, John would be the first person to, you know, there's spirituality, there's religion.
Right.
He'd be the first person to say it's all connected to the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, may the force be with you. It's all, we can, I like how he describes different religions as airlines, different airlines. And,
you
can go on a,
yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you're just taking
exactly.
different carriers.
Mm-hmm. Yes, different carriers will take you there. You've got a different pilot. You got a different meal. Maybe there's a different movie showing, but they're all going to get you to that same destination. So it doesn't, you know, you don't have to feel as though this one is the thing you have to believe to get your miracles, and that it's very universal.
Certainly, I agree with that. So true. Mm-hmm. How did your partnership with Chicken Soup come about for this wonderful book?
Well, that's another miracle. you see, the more you're open to it, the more they do happen.
Right.
And it's actually, I had finished a book, I had done a book with, and this woman's story is in this Our Hope and Miracles book, Scarlett Lewis, whose little boy Jesse had was one of the children shot in the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary 2 years ago. And we had done a book. I wrote a memoir with her and about Jesse, and she had been giving interviews about the book, and she somewhere along the way had mentioned in a small interview that our coming together as a writing team had sort of a miraculous origin, and the editor called me up and said, well, whatever this miraculous origin is, we'd like for you to write about it. Which I did for their last book called Among Angels Among Us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting story. Shall I tell you what it was?
Go ahead. Yeah. Yeah.
I had been on a book deadline, another book deadline, and I got a call to write this book I got a call from Hay House, they're the ones who published the John Edward books, saying, mm-hmm. We've got this book for you. You've got to do it. It's perfect for you. And I said, I can't. I'm on deadline. They're like, you have to do it within the next 2 months. I'm like, I'm on a deadline of this other book. There's no way I can do it. But tell me what it is. So they told me it was Scarlett, and they told me about little Jesse, and that she'd been getting all these signs. And I said, look, there's no way I can do it. And I said, please just call her up. Her name is Scarlett Lewis, da-da-da-da-da-da. I'm like, Scarlett? Well, my own story, and this is what I wrote about, was that my dearest, dearest friend, Norris Miller, wife of Norman Miller, she and I used to nickname each other Scarlett and Melanie from Gone with the Wind.
Yes.
And our sign was to be that, you know, she passed away a few years ago. Her sign to me was that to get in touch with me, she has to go through the word Scarlett. And this was the first time I'd heard the name Scarlett in the 2-3 years since she had passed away. And I thought, oh, well, I'll have to just call her up. They gave me the name. She said the name Scarlett. Her name's Scarlett. How often do you meet a Scarlett? and this is for the hope. This is for the Chicken Soup book that came out just a few months ago. And and so I called her up, and we're talking, and we find out all these coincidences. And the biggest one was that I told her, listen, I can't do your book. I the only reason I called you is because your name's Scarlett. And I told her the whole story about Norris Mailer, and she said. Wait, and I said, my friend Norris, she said, do you mean Norris Mailer? And I said, yes. She goes, my mother's sitting here right now. She just finished reading her autobiography.
Wow.
And I said, well, I said, right there, and then I said, I guess I'm doing your book. Hung up the phone, and I looked at the Scarlett doll. Norris had given me this beautiful Scarlett O'Hara doll that Norman had given to her as a gift. And I said, how? And I'm talking to Scarlett, and I'm talking to Norris, and I'm saying, how the heck am I supposed to do two books now in 2 months? One was impossible enough.
Mm-hmm.
A minute later, the phone rang. It was my other author saying, Natasha, I got to go out of town for 2 months. We got to take a 2-month break. We're moving the deadline. Are you okay without me for 2 months? So there it was. There was my 2 months to do Scarlett's book.
Yeah.
And that's how I got in touch with Hope and Miracles, with the Chicken Soup.
It's a fascinating story. The answers are all around us. The signs are all around us. And if we don't fight it, it's there.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of people say, well, how do you invite more miracles into your life, or how do you get more miracles to come into your life? Well, I think either, you know, you have to know they're already there. You just have to notice them or be open to them, you know, and they're there.
In his foreword, John Edwards talked about the many shapes and sizes of miracles come in. Can you please elaborate on that?
I think it's a little bit like what we were saying. John and I have talked a lot about that, and that a miracle doesn't always have to be a burning bush or writing in the sky, even though we do have our one story in this book of actual writing in the sky. That a lot of people who say they don't have miracles in life, they forget that we take some everyday miracles for granted. I mean, babies are being born every minute. That's a miracle. This is one of the things John was talking about. Or, you know, he was saying that, you know, every spring he's amazed when you see the trees, like, bud. Mm-hmm. I am, too. You think, my gosh, like, we take these things for granted. So those are small yet big miracles. Small because people don't notice them anymore. Mm-hmm. But the littlest thing could be a miracle. Like, you know, a stranger on the street does something that helps you. So to the big giant miracle where someone pulls you off the street and saves your life, or you know, there's a great span of them, and that we shouldn't, you know, denigrate the little ones because they're just as miraculous.
So true. I think it's a process of what we pay attention to. I'm sure when our parents were growing up and grandparents, the TV set was a miracle. Of course, now...
to me, still, a telephone's a miracle. You know, right. I think, like, my gosh, you can talk to someone in another, you know, across the ocean.
Right.
I can't even believe it still.
Right, right.
Never mind.
In real time.
I know.
It's just amazing.
Well, here I am, you know, one of the stories in my book that we'll probably talk about is the story about mm-hmm. my mom. They, you know, during the six to seven years, there was no letters going across, and they couldn't be in touch with each other, with their family in America. I mean, if that today, just these things would never happen.
Right,
which is crazy.
So true. Please tell us about the introduction you and Amy Newmark did. I thought it was a very interesting introduction.
Yeah, that was funny because I actually originally wrote the three little stories I tell in that introduction was originally together as a story. Mm-hmm. I had written a story called 20 Minutes. We were chatting one day at lunch, Amy and I, and I was saying, you know, it's amazing. We're trying to figure out what a miracle was, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I was saying, you know, or divine intervention. We're talking about divine intervention. I said, do you think this is divine intervention? And I said, you know, I have all these stories in my life and my friends' lives where a matter of 20 minutes saved their life. And it is amazing how many times there's always a story like that. I think every time, you know, a plane crashes or there's some sort of catastrophe, someone was stopped for some reason and was late. Lame and I were talking about how we're always late. People always chide us on being late. And I said, yeah, but, you know, in my family and with my friends, being late saves your life. So I had written that as an original story, and then she started talking about her father who had missed a flight because the family's always late. He missed the flight. And then she took my story and hers, and she combined them, which was great. So these were really sort of divine intervention in a way where something happened and your lives were saved. We started off with my grandfather's Titanic story, which I'm so happy to have, like, told this story. And the funny thing was, you know, he was scheduled to be on the Titanic, and his friend who he was waiting for was late. And they missed the boat. He was waiting for his friend. His friend showed up about 20 minutes too late, and they missed it. They literally missed the boat. And the funny thing is, when I interviewed James Cameron when the film Titanic came out, and by then, of course, the story in my family had been embellished that then my grandfather and his buddy got on a rowboat, and they tried to catch up to the Titanic, and they saw it sink, and he laughed his head off. But it was about, he laughed. He said, there's no way. But anyway, the point was that my grandfather missed the Titanic by 20 minutes. A dear friend of mine missed a train crash because he overslept.
Mm-hmm.
And we ended up with a story with my former roommate, who was who worked in the World Trade Center. Her babysitter was 20 minutes late. She got to her desk. She was arriving 20 minutes later than she normally would, and she would have been sitting in that first tower that was hit. She got out of the subway, smelled the smoke, went right back to the subway, and went right back uptown on the last subway that was still moving in Manhattan. And because her babysitter was 20 minutes late, she is alive today. And so this is what the introduction is about. So we're combining our divine interventions.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating that sometimes things like this happen, we don't think of it as miracles. In some ways, we get aggravated, the fact that we miss something, this, that, and we don't realize the chain reaction that it caused.
Totally. This is why I tell people, don't be mad at me if I'm late. I probably saved our lives.
I like that. I'm going to use that. I'm going to use that line. Thanks, Natasha. I'm going to use that line the next time.
Think of how many lives I've probably saved.
There you go.
Every time I'm late.
There you go. It's like, hey, it's not about me, you guys. It's not about me now. Let's talk about you.
Oh, totally, totally. You should be thanking me for being late.
That's right. I like that. I'm going to use that one.
Yes, perhaps I have an inner knowing that something, I'm saving us.
That's right. You are so all wrapped up with things, you can't get the signal. I'm getting your signal.
That's right. You may not understand this right now, but I'm doing this for your own good.
That's right. There you go. How can readers be on the lookout for miracles in their everyday life?
I think it's kind of like what we were talking about, where sometimes it's subtle and small.
Yeah, yeah.
That it's about noticing them. It's about, you know, and again, I think John mentioned this in his foreword, that we are so, especially in the last 10 years, our minds are so focused on BlackBerries and iPhones and games and communicating that way, that people don't look up anymore.
Yeah.
And just looking up and around, you see them. I know that when I go to the park, sometimes when I'm just so crazy busy with writing and I want to take a break, I go walk in Central Park. Even in Central Park, stand there and you look around and you see so much life and so many stories. And then you just talk to one person and you hear something incredible. You know, you get the coffee from the coffee guy and he starts telling you how his family escaped, you know, whatever, in Poland. And
then
you start hearing stories and you realize that everyone's got one. And so I just also think that people... I don't know how we want to define the word miracle. People don't like to use that word. They think, oh, this is a coincidence, a lot of people are used to thinking negatively. They don't think in terms of, wow, that was a miracle.
Mm-hmm.
So little things happen, and I think it's almost like we want to redefine them and say, well, that is miraculous. I mean... You know, the timing of this phone call came in today, and that's how I got the job, or, I think a lot of people call it good luck. Something happens,
right,
and they say, well, that was lucky. And you know what, that's I would consider those things little miracles. So I think it's just looking at the perception of it.
I agree. I think a lot of times people, when you talk about miracles like John was addressing, let's talk about a Big Bang thing. If it's anything less than that, well, it's nothing spectacular, you know. I mean, my life today is fine. But I think there are small miracles happening around us all the time, and we just fail to notice them.
Yes. Yes. Or we don't call it that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't think of them with that perspective. But, yes, I totally agree with you.
Did you learn something special from reading all the amazing stories of hope that people submitted for this book?
I think it's funny because I think it was more of a, because I've been writing about this kind of thing for a while.
Mm-hmm.
The amazing thing was having them, all these stories together in one book, sort of reconfirmed the things I knew.
Mm-hmm.
That you know, about miracles are possible anywhere. You know, when you least expect it, that, you know, with hard work sometimes, you know, you can make anything happen. I think of one of the stories in the book, and I know we'll get to stories, but with Dana, was quadriplegic. I mean, when she was woke up in the hospital after she had been a 19-year-old girl in the Navy, raped and thrown off a cliff, left to die 75 feet off a cliff, and woke up in the hospital the next day paralyzed, mm-hmm. couldn't breathe. The doctors didn't think she would survive, never mind ever breathe alone or eat. Doctors told her that constantly. Friends told her that. Everyone. She did not believe it. And today, she walks. And we have a great story in there about...
Right.
You know, when I read her story, and I don't know if you want to talk about her story right now, but...
Yeah, go ahead.
In our Hope and Miracles book, we have our story of Dana, and she's, you know, she's in a wheelchair, and she's driving, and she gets stuck in the mud somewhere in the wilderness of Middle America. I'm trying to remember where she was. And there's no people around, and she can't get the car going, and she has to get to this little outhouse to sort of spend the night. I can't remember why she can't spend the night in the car, but she's got her dog, and they got to make this trek like 20, 30, 50 feet to this little outhouse. She figures, okay, she does everything to try and get the car out. Like she crawls to the wheel and tries to dig it out of the mud. She, you know, she's honking for hours. She's, you know, the dog goes and fetches things to try, you know, sticks to put underneath for traction. Mm-hmm. Anyway, she tries everything. So she puts on all her clothes and grabs, like, the few little snacks she had in the car, and she and her dog have to make this trek, like, basically 50 feet to this outhouse. They figure, I'll stay in there, and someone will come in the morning, and we'll try. Anyway, so, of course, what, you know, the journey, those 50 feet, is so... tumultuous, is so mm-hmm. it's like an obstacle course ending with coyotes surrounding them. Now, she's telling me this story, and I'm thinking, man, I would have given up. I would have given up. But, you know, but there's just so much, like, she just never gives up. And so, in answer to your original question, it always, mm-hmm. when I read these stories or hear these stories, they confirm to me, don't give up. Because
yeah.
I think when you read these stories, then you'll remember them. So when your time comes, when you're lying in the mud with coyotes surrounding you and howling, hungry, ready to pounce on you, and you can't walk, you know, she didn't
yeah.
give up. We can't give up either.
Mm-hmm.
And these stories reconfirm that for me. Each story I read just reconfirmed. Don't forget, don't give up. Work
right,
hard.
Right,
stay
right.
positive. You can do it.
Right.
Miracles can happen. You never know. And that's what
that's
they do.
That's right. Ultimately, what I get it to, the miracles that you celebrate, the generic you, that is in the eye of the beholder. Because it depends
mm-hmm.
on what kind of miracles you're looking for. If you're looking for the burning bush, then you know that is your miracle. If you're getting locked out of your house and you need
mm-hmm.
to get in, and if you manage
mm-hmm.
to get in a sort of an obscure way, that's a miracle that happened for you.
Totally, totally. I mean, all these, as we're talking, these little things are coming to my mind that have
mm-hmm.
happened to me in the past that would be I would consider now a little miracle. I remember
yeah.
my very first story that I had to write for People magazine. They sent me out of town on a story. I didn't have a laptop. I had to get back on the plane and get back to write it for the deadline. And I went to my flight, and my flight was full. And I'm sitting there crying because I couldn't get on the plane and get back and write my story, my very first story for this very big magazine. And someone came up to me and said, I'll give you my seat.
Mm.
And they saw me crying.
Yeah,
and I thought,
yeah.
well, that miracle changed my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
so these little things happen all the time.
Right. So interesting. What would you like for the readers to gain from reading Hope and Miracles?
I think the same thing that I gain when I read them, which is reminding us that it doesn't is giving us hope, because again, and I know I'm repeating myself, but we're kind of all in this together. We need to all help each other keep going as positively and as happily as we can, and I think if these stories can make a person feel good and feel hopeful, and then that's contagious. I know that when I walk out the door and I'm feeling hopeful and happy and I see someone in distress, I help them. I mean, I would probably do it anyway, but there's a whole paying it forward feeling, I think, that someone helps us with their story and then we help someone else. And then, you know, it makes for a happier world. So I would hope that it would inspire, that these stories would inspire and give hope to the readers, who then will in turn do the same for somebody else.
That's wonderful. I have selected several stories from the book as talking points for this morning. Please give us a short rundown of these stories. They are wonderful stories, but obviously they have so many stories that will move you in different ways and relate to in different ways. The very first one is from the first chapter, Messages from Heaven. And I know you've talked about this a little bit, but let's go into a little detail about this particular story. Jesse in the Sky.
Yes, Jesse. So Scarlett is the one I talked about whose son was killed in the Sandy Hook school massacre. And this was still within the first few weeks after he had been killed. And she had been getting signs from him, what she considers signs and what I would consider signs too. You know, little things like she goes to bed and, you know, his toy soldier is on her pillow or, you know, or in the middle of the night, his other toy starts, you know, animating and come to life and is beeping downstairs. So she had been telling, she's not the kind of person who goes to psychics, but she had been at the grave one day and two women came up to her and they were psychics and they said they felt drawn to coming to the grave and paying their respects. Anyway, they had given her their card and she had told them, she was getting on a plane with her other son, her elder son, to Florida. And they needed a break. They needed a break to get out of Sandy Hook and just sort of think a bit and feel and grieve because the whole town was in such mourning. But she had, before she'd gotten on the plane, she had texted one of these psychics and she had said, she told them about the signs. When she got off the plane, she got a text from one of them saying, gosh, maybe he's stuck. Maybe he's sending you signs because he's stuck here. He can't move onward, you know, whatever, something like that. And it was, it broke Scarlett's heart because she thought, am I, you know, I'm embracing these signs I'm getting as if, because they're giving me such comfort. Every time she gets a sign, she feels comfort that she feels he's in heaven and that he's reaching out to her to say, hey, Mom, I'm okay. And, you know, she's in a way depending on these signs, you know, your grieving mother.
Right.
And so then she got this sentence saying perhaps, you know, in a way, she took it as, in a way, your grief is holding him back from going to heaven. So she went into the ladies' room at the airport, I think this is Orlando, and she sobbed and sobbed and sobbed. And she's quite religious in a Christian way, and she spoke out loud to Jesse, and she said, Jesse, I love you, Mama loves you, and I don't want to hold you back, so I will be okay. Don't worry about me. I want you to go to Jesus. I want you to be with Jesus, and don't worry about Mom. I will be fine. Don't hold back. Don't linger here just because of my grief. Don't let me hold you back. She was sobbing and sobbing. So she leaves the bathroom and gets into the rental car with her son and JT, and they're driving along the highway, just having left the airport, and both of them look up in the sky, and they just can't believe what they see. There in the sky is skywriting saying Jesse and Jesus in the sky. A plane had just finished writing it, and not only that, but the J was written backwards in the way that Jesse writes it. Now, how do we explain this?
Yeah.
At first, when I spoke to her, she hadn't investigated anything. But in the end of the story, we do say that with a little investigation, there was we discovered that there's a team of two pilots who for a few years had been writing up inspirational things like that in the sky. But it still doesn't explain. How would they know that she was leaving the airport at that time, impossible, and write that message? So that to her, you know, that's a writing in the sky miracle. And she was, like, you know, obviously completely comforted by that. Incredibly.
That's just amazing, isn't it? It's just so
amazing.
What
do you think about that? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, what would you think? I mean, sometimes things happen and there's just no way to explain it. You know, we know for sure no one, you know, hired these people to do this.
Right.
But so even if there are these two guys who are pilots who are in the sky doing these things, there's the fact that they were inspired to write that at that minute is still a miracle. I mean, it took 1 minute and then it was gone.
Right.
So the timing of it had to have been exact.
When you hear stories like that, it makes you wonder what's going on in terms of, is there a different kind of a set of world around us in a way?
I know. I wish we knew just a little more, don't you?
Yeah, like, that's right.
I want us just to be like one notch up and know just a little more, like what is going on under the surface here.
That's correct. I mean, I couldn't put it any better than that. That's perfect. The next one is in the same category, Messages from Heaven, A Feather from Heaven by Tina Wagner Madden.
I love that one, too. And this is a common thing. I don't know why feathers are common, but in this story, a woman's mother passes away, and her best friend, the mom's best friend, before the mom passes away, gives her a little, like a little poem about angels. And in the envelope where the poem is, there's a little, tiny, little white feather. And they laugh about it. They say, oh, that's must have been some little angel, some small angel. That's such a small, little white feather. Well, the friend says, I want you to, when you get to heaven, you know, no pressure or anything, but please send me a feather to let me know you're okay. And it's so funny because a lot of people do ask for feathers. They say that to people and they get feathers assigned. So, of course, a week after this woman passes away, the friend calls up the daughter and says, you won't believe it. I'm sitting here watching TV with my granddaughter, and all of a sudden my granddaughter like lunges into the air and grabs something. And I said, what's that? Well, a feather had been, exact same kind of feather, floating down. And there it was. She got her feather. So they took this as a sign that this is the mom saying, hey, I'm here, everything's fine, don't worry about it. But that's that story. How
it's interesting,
that?
Isn't it?
I mean, how, you know, I guess, and how do we can't explain everything. It's not like we see feathers falling from, you know, down from the living room ceiling every day. So something's going on.
Right. How did it get there kind of thing? It's just amazing.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like there's a winged animal in the in the house or any birds. So
that's
who knows? Yeah.
So true. The next chapter is about miraculous healing, and the story is The Healing Hand of God by Donna Fawcett.
Yes. Oh, yes. This is a story about a four-year-old girl. The family's camping. And she falls into the campfire. They're there roasting marshmallows, and in one split second, the chair kind of collapses. She falls forward, and the family grabs her, and they race her to the hospital. And of course, the doctor gives a, you know, prognosis of, you know, months in wheelchair, and she won't be able to walk. Her feet are all burned. She's going to have skin grafts. She's got second and third degree burns all over her feet, legs. So 2 weeks later, I think that the mom was meant to be on a religious retreat where she asked her friends on the retreat, I think 200 women, to pray for her daughter, which they did. And a few days after that, they take the little girl to the doctor. The doctor's taking off the bandages to change them, very painful. And all of a sudden, the doctor's stunned. Well, what's the matter? Her feet are perfect. Not a scar, not a scratch, nothing. Yeah, just the doctor's dumbfounded. I mean, you know, you always often have doctors in these situations that are like, I don't know. I have no idea what happened. Right.
This would be kind of almost that burning bush kind of thing. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah. I know. I mean, when it's something so dramatic like that, you have to wonder, you know, how did this happen? I mean, there's coincidences, there's the being late, there's that, but then there's this where, like, experts are dumbfounded as to how did this happen. There's no logic to it. Maybe if we believe things, maybe if we pray for things, maybe if we think and hope.
I think so, because you brought up something very interesting. The time that you spend with John Edwards, I'm sure you can relate to that too, because one of the things he is an advocate for is ask, pray,
mm-hmm.
and you will be surprised that those prayers will be answered.
Yes, he's a very big believer of, you know, in any way that you can put your intention out to the universe.
Right.
That, you know, in all the great philosophers, I think, therefore I am, and Jesus would have said it, and I'm sure, you know, all the great ones said something about,
mm-hmm.
you know, if
mm-hmm.
you think it and believe it and say it, you make it true.
Right.
And that's what prayer can be as well, because it's almost like what you put out there and what you believe, the universe has to conspire to agree with your thoughts and feelings. It has to balance it out. So if you're thinking it and feeling it and believing it, the universe around you adjusts to make it so. This is sort of the theory of it.
Right, right. The next section is Touched by an Angel, and the story is The Visitor by Cheryl Blant Oliver.
Oh, yes. Well, Cheryl's two daughters were in a car accident about a year ago. This is a very recent event. And this you know, I would characterize this as, you know, giving hope to somebody. How we give hope to another person, because obviously you lose one child, how do you survive that? You lose two daughters, two beautiful teenage daughters, in, you know, 0.6 seconds, I think she said it was, and that you've given your whole heart to. How do you survive it? So this story starts where, you know, it's a few days after the funeral, and, you know, how do you have a will to live at this point? And this is what I mean about how one person's story can affect another person's story, can affect another person's life and what they do at that moment. Because I'm sure in that moment, you know, she's not eating, she can't eat, she can barely drink water, she can't get out of her pajamas, and the house, I think, had been busy for days and days. People coming in, bringing food, flowers everywhere. And for some reason, in that 1 hour, it was quiet. There were no people. Her relatives were in another room. The door rang. She wouldn't normally have answered it. She would have normally had someone else answer, but no one was coming. So she went to answer it. And there's this old little lady there, standing there with a basket and her cane. And she says, "I've come to, you know, I read about your story, and I've come to, you know, give you my condolences, and I've come to pray with you." And Cheryl says, "Oh, okay." So they do a little prayer, and then she says, "I want to tell you a story. Can I tell you a story?" And this woman starts to tell a story about her own life, a tragic, tragic childhood moment where she's sitting on her mother's lap. Yeah, it's a mother's lap. The father comes out in the backyard, shoots the mother in the head, takes the little girl, who's the grandmother, the old lady, walks into the house, shoots himself, and so there's the little girl left with her sister there, and then she's just witnessed both her parents, you know, the murder and the suicide.
Yeah.
And so this woman, the reason this old woman tells her this story is to let her know that she can survive. She will survive it, that even if she feels right now that there's just no way possible that she will survive this grief and this pain, This woman says, "I'm here to tell you, as proof, standing here in front of you, that you will survive this, and you will have a life, and you will be happy again." Mm-hmm. And that sometimes, that's what I mean about the jumping off the bridge thing. Sometimes
right.
you need one person to tell you their story of survival, and then you can survive, just knowing that it's possible. And Cheryl's writing a book about this now, about her whole, her background was both her parents killed themselves. So she had already been through lots of death and grief in the family, and it's about grief and surviving. And so that's her story, and she never forgot that woman. She never knew who she was. She just disappeared. Yeah.
It's so interesting. The next section is titled Divine Intervention, and the story is Heavenly Voices by Deborah Voigt.
Yes. Debbie And I'll just give this little plug because I just Debbie's memoir has just is hitting the bookstores next week, and we took this story from there and put this in the Chicken Soup book. Deborah Voight is a very famous soprano, and she grew up in a very strict Southern Baptist household, but she knew from childhood that she wanted to sing. By age three, she was belting out, you know, My Fair Lady and The Sound of Music and dressing up, and she was just a natural. But in the strict religious household, there was this feeling of, you know, we don't want you singing show tunes, you know, get into the choir, sing the hymns. You know, music is from God, for God, you know, about God. And so her parents weren't quite understanding that, you know, you can find God in Audrey Hepburn as well. So it was a struggle for her all her young years because she felt pulled to sing all this beautiful kind of music that she wanted to sing, but she was being diverted and told that it was, you know, not proper. And it was a struggle until this one day, that's what we talk about in this story, Heavenly Voices, where she wakes up early in the morning, and I think she at that point she was just about to give up, and she hears a voice saying, "You are meant to sing." You know, it's like the voice of Charlton Heston, by the way. You know, it's one of those. In other words, it's God, and or George Burns. But she hears this voice, and to her, it's God telling her, "Stick to your path. You know this is what you're meant to do. You are meant to do this. Don't worry about what other people say." And it changed her life. She would not be a famous operatic singer on the stage of the Met or in Venice today had she not had that turning point moment. So she considers that very much a divine intervention in her life. Very much so.
Such a powerful story. The next one is in the category of Think Positive, The Godfather and His Daughter, by Rita Gigante.
Yep, Rita Gigante.
Yeah.
Rita's father was a very famous, can never say it properly in the Italian, capi di tutti capo. He was the head of the five New York crime families. Gambinos, Genovese, okay? You know. We've all seen The Godfather.
So needless to say, you are connected yourself, right? You're taking care.
I know. See how the interesting people I meet.
Oh, that's right.
I know. So Rita is the youngest of the kids. And, you know, again, a struggle her whole life to come to terms with the fact that her father was the head of the Genovese crime family for many, many years. Now, he's very famous. And if you're a New Yorker, a lot of the New Yorkers will remember that he was known for roaming around the West Village in his pajamas. As a matter of fact, the creator of The Sopranos, slightly based the character of Uncle Junior, I think his name is, on her father, Vincent Gigante, because I think in The Sopranos they have him sort of faking mental illness and walk around in his pajamas. Well, this is what Vincent was known for, because he for about 20 years he faked mental illness, and this was to help keep him from going to jail. So Rita, as she's growing up, she becomes all about the truth. Okay, her father's living this dual life, and Rita is all about the truth. She grows up, she becomes a healer, and she wants, at this point in the story, her father is in jail, in prison, and he's up for, I believe, parole. There's something going on that there's a chance that he could get out, or a chance that the sentence could be lessened. Now, then what happens is they want to call in the family to be interrogated in court against their father, and he says, "No, we can't do that." But there's all sorts of nuances of legal stuff that I didn't put in there. But what happens is Rita ends up sending her father a letter about who she is and about being truthful. And what happens is this letter affects him so much that after 20, 25 years of pretending to be mentally ill in front of all the FBI and the world, he gets on the stand and he admits it. He frees himself. Yeah, I know. He says, this is it. I was joking. I was lying. I admit this. And, you know, in a way, he does it to sort of prevent his family from being called in and to cause more hurt. But at the same time, you know, one of the most moving things she says is that he condemns himself to more time behind bars, but now he's a freer man than he ever was because he doesn't have to lie anymore. So that's a story about her wanting truth and living truth and sending this letter to him that she feels, you know, across the country from words she wrote in the paper affected him so much that he wanted to live a truth as well.
Wonderful. Let's talk about the next section, Mysterious Miracles, When the Rocks Cried Out by Betty Schumann.
Now, again, this is a story where how do we explain what happened? So this woman, her husband, her family, they have a cottage, a cabin, and at one point they're noticing that the lake is sort of moving closer and eating away the shoreline, and they hire somebody and think, okay, well, maybe we'll build a little wall of rocks. They order a bunch of rocks, and a guy comes over with a truck with all these rocks, and it's not that many rocks. They can only afford so many rocks at this point, but what happens is, so they go in their house, and this guy's left to put the rocks up. They wake up the next day, and the whole shoreline is full of a wall of rocks, you know, enough for, you know, 20 truckloads.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, what the heck happened? Did this guy just bring more rocks? What? And they call him up. He goes, you know, I just couldn't believe it. He said, every time I went back to the truck and got more rocks and put it on the shoreline, I'd go back to the truck again, and it was like there was no less rocks there. The amount of rocks never diminished. I mean, I would have lots of questions for her. I want to know, like, when he left, was there still rocks in the truck? But so he just kept going, and he did the whole job that they needed along the shoreline because the rocks were endless.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, how do we explain this? We don't know.
It reminds me of that story about the fish in the Bible.
Oh, yeah, right.
The bread and the fish and so forth, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Loaves, fishes, and loaves, right.
Yeah,
we got one
yeah.
fish, we got one piece of bread, we got 500 people, hungry people. We got to feed
right.
them.
Right,
you
right.
know,
I
forgot one thing to tell you, which is I think the first miracle story I ever heard when I was a kid, was the Carol Burnett story. Do you know that story?
Mm-mm, no.
Carol Burnett's a comedian. And
Yeah, I know her. Mm-hmm. I know of her.
Okay,
yeah.
she talks about how they were so poor, and she wanted to go to college, and she hoped and hoped and hoped, and everyone told her it's impossible, there was no money, and she had got accepted to this college, and there was a certain amount of money she needed, and one day she went to the mailbox, and there was a check. Someone had sent a check. She never knew to this day who it was. And I remember being so, this is linked to, you know, how I got into these stories. I remember being so amazed at that story that I was always on the lookout for other stories like that, about things like this happening.
That's a wonderful story. The final story for me, anyway, from my end, will be Miraculous Reunion, His Waiting. And this story is by you.
Yes. This is my mother's story. And I'm so... it's so funny because we had written all our stories, and then we had space for one more. I think one of them had to drop. We had to drop, and then you know we were up to deadline, and you know, do you have another story? And I'm like, well, there's this one story I was thinking about writing, but I didn't know if it was right for the book. But then I decided it's a story of hope, and I decided it's a story that more people can relate to because it's just about keeping hope. And it's my mom's story, and I'm so happy to get in there because she told me this story over and over and over again. I made her tell me over and over. And every time she told me, I would cry. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote it up for the book, and it's a story about how she was in the old country, Macedonia, and her father was preparing to move the whole family to America. He had come early. He had got a house. He'd got a job. Everything was all, you know, ready, and they all had American citizenship because he had gotten it from fighting in World War One. Although my mother and his sisters had never been here, but he signed them up with their citizenship at the consulate as soon as they were born. So they were all ready to come over when war broke out. Mm-hmm. And that was it. They had tickets. They were on the way to the ship, and, you know, they couldn't get on it. They couldn't get across. And for the next 6-7 years, there was no leaving. There were no letters. He didn't know if they were dead or alive. You know, they didn't know what he was doing. You know, meanwhile, he's in Pennsylvania trying to get them out, trying to, you know, writing letters to politicians, doing everything possible. So they spend 6-7 years, 8 years maybe, without him, mm-hmm. and no communication. And meanwhile, the German soldiers come to town. They make my mother's house their headquarters. And for years, they're living there in the mm-hmm. atrium of the house, young soldiers mm-hmm. lined up. So what it is, it ends up being a story of hope that, you know, my mother, for all those years, would say to her mother, my mother was the eldest, so she really became the comforter in the family. And she would say to her mother, "Don't worry, Mom. We'll see him one day. We'll get to him. He's waiting for us. He's waiting for us." And so I have goosebumps just telling this. And so, of course, when the war is finally over, arrangements are quickly made by the U.S. consulate mm-hmm. for them to be on the first boat out, which isn't even a passenger boat. It's like a cargo ship. I wish mm-hmm. I could ask her more questions. My mom passed away in 93, but they get in this cargo ship. There's, I think, one other family there. The ship brings them across for weeks. And, you know, my mother's now, she was 7 when her father left. Now she's 14, 15. And they get to the New York Harbor, and they're like 200 feet from the dock, and the ship stops. What's going on here? Well, the dock workers are on strike. Sorry.
Oh, no.
Sorry. Sorry, my grandfather's on the dock. You know, he can see the ship. They can see the dock. I'm sorry, ma'am, but, you know, we might be stranded here for days. We can't
right.
cross this, you know, strike line here. Well, my grandfather arranges to pay somebody, you know, a lot of American dollars to take his tugboat and get them. And unbeknownst to him, the tugboat comes and gets them. He thinks it's going to be a few hours. He goes to get a cup of coffee. He's been waiting in this dock for days for the ship to arrive. He goes to get a cup of coffee. And meanwhile, they're climbing down the rope from the ship, getting the tugboat. They arrive on the dock. There's no one there. And they're like, now what are we going to do? Now what are we going to do, says my grandmother. Well, my mother, who knew her father the best and remembered him the best of all the girls, because she was the eldest and she was his favorite, sees from a distance, far, far, far distance, this shadowy, shadowy figure walking toward them. She recognizes his walk, and she runs toward him. And they all run toward him, and they have their reunion. But, you know, and it's a very, and my grandfather loses his voice. He I don't think he could talk for days, I remember her telling me, just mm-hmm. in shock that he'd been waiting for them for so long. So to me, it's a story about not giving up hope. And it's a story that other people can relate to. You know, it's not a skywriting. It's not, you know, a feather. It's sort of real life. Don't give up. Hope that
right.
what you want can happen. And I'll just tell you one funny thing. When we had to decide to write this story, when I decided to write the story, when Amy called and said, "Hey, we need one more story," it was
yeah.
late at night, and I think they needed it for the next morning because we were going to press. And I was so tired because I was working on a million deadlines. And I don't think I've been awake for 2 nights, and I thought, oh, do I have the energy to write this story? And here's another little sort of little miracle thing. I
yeah.
was staying in a friend's apartment in the Upper West Side, and I look out the window, and I realize, I'm watching the sunset, which is on the 36th floor. I look outside, and I realize I'm standing right above the spot where my mother arrived on the
wow.
boat.
Wow.
I look down, I'm like, that's right there. There's the ship coming in. And I said,
wow.
"All right, so it's just like the Scarlet story and the chicken suit." I said, "That's it. I guess I'm writing the story. There's my sign." So yeah. I wrote it.
That's amazing. That really is. What are some of your favorite stories?
You know, I love the story. Sometimes it's the simplest story, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. The old lady who's like 89.
That's right. Yeah,
and
I like that
she,
one too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and she has a fall, and again, this is something I also like, the ones that people couldn't relate to in their own lives. This is something that she has a fall, and she's 89, and the doctor tells her she'll never walk again. She fractures her vertebrae, and she just believes she's going to walk again. And a lot of people 89 would even give up, like, oh, it's all over, you know?
Right.
But she doesn't give up, and she's religious, and she prays, but not only that, but the whole point is that she works hard at it, too. She works hard at it, does her exercises, you know, she believes that anything's possible, and, you know, 2 years later, she's walking. So, again, you can never believe that, you don't need to believe the negative.
Right.
That's one of my favorites. I like that one. Because it, you know, we can all relate to that, and we all have something.
Certainly.
That mm-hmm. will. And another one is the Immaculate Story. I don't think we talked
mm-hmm.
about that one.
No, no. I like that one too, yes.
Mm-hmm. That, I mean, her story, she's written several books, and she's a survivor of the Rwanda genocide. And she hid in a bathroom for 3 months during the genocide with like 7 or 8 other women squeezed in a pastor's house. He hid them in the bathroom, and he put like a big chest of drawers in front of the door so that when the killers would come and search for people to kill the Hutus and Tutsis, they were hidden. And she tells this story is after the genocide, where she had nothing. You know, most of her family had been killed with the machetes, and now she has just like the threads of clothes on her back, no food, nothing. And what does she have to do? She has to try and find a job. Anyway, through a whole series of crazy events, you know, she's on the ground crying because all she can think of is to get this one job. She needs to get her school transcripts. And she's crying on the ground, and her school is hours away. How is she supposed to get it? Meanwhile, all of a sudden she hears beep, beep, beep. A car goes by. It's an old professor of hers. Hey, Immaculate, you're alive. This is great. Well, he gives her a ride to the school. She goes to her dorm room where everything has been ransacked, except she sees a tiny little envelope on the floor. They must have missed it. Whoever took everything from her room, in the envelope, her school transcripts, and, you know, $30, I think. It's enough to get her back home, buy food, get something to wear, go for the job interview, and she gets the job. But I love that story.
Isn't that something? I mean, it's like every one of us almost have our own definite journey that we need to be on.
Yes. And you know, I always want to know, I mean, had she been, you know, would something else had made that not happen? Like, she hasn't
right.
been on that road for the car to go by to get her to, you know, it was miraculous enough that she would meet someone she knew who was Tutsi, who was still alive. Never
right.
mind, in a car
right.
on the way to the
right.
school where she has to get her transcripts. I mean, so
right.
many things had to be in place that you have to sometimes think that maybe there's just, I don't know. I don't know if we have the words to,
right.
to describe it. You know, people have, since time began, you know, have made religions and,
right.
you know, to try and explain all this stuff. But one thing for sure is we know it happens.
Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
I think this book is going to be sort of in most of your major bookstores everywhere. It comes out February 10th, Barnes & Noble's.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, oh, definitely. It's on Amazon already. That's and all those websites for the bookstores. February 10th, this book will be everywhere. And for me, you know, I've been on deadline so much, I haven't put together my own website, but I do have a Facebook page that people can check out.
Fantastic.
With all my happenings.
Wonderful. You know? They just Google you. That's what they need to do.
Yes. You can Google me. I'm all over there.
Fantastic. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
A recipe for living. I'm just trying to have something ready for you for that because I know you asked that question.
And it's not two eggs over easy either now.
You know, it reminds me of that guy who whose name I can't think of because my brain's not working right now, but who interviews the celebrities, and he always asks them, if you were a tree, what tree would you be? Or you know who I mean, at the actor's studio, whose name I can't think of.
I can't remember his name, but I know who you're talking about.
You know who I mean.
Yeah.
I think I want to say, you know, what our stories really do represent is kind of how I live. Mm-hmm. You know, like the to remember that, you know, with hard work, miracles are possible, and that you can't give up hope. And to me, my recipe really is just, it's the same thing you've heard from everybody before. Mm-hmm. Be kind and go out there and have hope and give hope, because like this book, you can connect with other people, and we can survive this life and thrive. And we all have days where things happen in our life that are sad and tough,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's the woman who, you know, you fracture and someone tells you you're not going to walk again, or you're surrounded by the coyotes, or you're on the road and your whole family's been massacred and you can't even eat, and, you know, or someone's keeping you from your dream of singing. We all have those days, and I think to just take a moment alone and remind yourself that to not listen to the negative and be positive, because you walk out the door and you're positive, and then you affect other people. And then we'll have a happier world.
That's correct.
And
that's correct.
Hopefully that's our goal.
That's wonderful. Natasha, thank you for the wonderful recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. It truly has been a pleasure. Thank you again, and have a blessed day. All the best to you in 2015.
Thank you so much, Shani, and same to you and to the listeners.
To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday. My guest will be Alison Carmen. She is a life coach and the author of The Gift of Maybe, Finding Hope and Possibility in Uncertain Times. Alison and I will be discussing how the gift of maybe provides us with the tools needed to embrace uncertainty as an opportunity. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening, and have a blessed week. Bye-bye.